Welcome to Wall Street Unspun with your host, Peter Schiff.
But it's a giant bubble in search of a pin, and it's going to find one.
Are you confused with the ups and downs in the economy and what it means to you?
Don't believe the propaganda, and that's what it is. When you're listening to an analyst on a lot of these popular financial shows, you're not getting investment advice. You're getting propaganda.
Get ready to untangle the web of misinformation provided by the mainstream media.
These firms are trying to sell you stocks. Their real clients, their banking clients, are trying to get rid of stuff.
And now, here's your host of Wall Street Unspun, the president of Euro Pacific Capital and a licensed broker with a passion for truth. It's Wall Street Unspun with Peter Schiff.
Hi, everybody. This is Peter Schiff, another live episode of Wall Street Unspun. This is Wednesday, what is it, April 5th? May 5th, 2009, maybe it's even the 6th, you know, I'm not sure. Anyway, I do the show live every Wednesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, 5 p.m. Pacific Time. I do it on shortwave radio 5.07 megahertz, and on my website at www.europac.net. And I'm taking your calls again live at 888-678-9597, 888-678-9597. Anyway, I want to talk initially about what's been going on in the markets and the huge rally we're seeing pretty much in everything around the world. And, you know, a lot of people on television, you know, I was on Kudlow and Company, I think, on Monday, and of course, not just when I'm on, you know, all the time now I'm watching these shows. And everybody is getting bullish. And they're bullish because the market's going up. Today, the news, we had a payroll number from that, you know, not the official numbers, but the company that comes out and has their own take on the payroll numbers. And they came out today and said only 400,000 or 500,000 jobs were lost. And since that was fewer jobs than people thought, the market is happy about that. Or today we come out, the stress tests, you know, these bogus stress tests, which is the equivalent of running gerbils over a suspension bridge and saying, hey, the bridge is sound. Several of the banks passed. But many of them, Bank of America, they say needs another $34 billion. Several other big banks, the government said, need to raise capital. Yet the market rose as if this is all good news that these banks can't even pass, that wimpy stress test. But you know, the reality is stocks are rising in price. But remember, they fell substantially. So, it's not that difficult when you fall, you know, such a big amount to rise. You know, they get that old Wall Street expression of a dead cat bounce, meaning if you, you know, drop a dead cat off a building, even it's going to bounce. It doesn't mean it's alive. But I don't know if this rally is going to, you know, end and we're going to make new lows, or maybe the lows are in. I don't know. But ultimately, I think we are going to put in lows, and the markets are going to go higher, even in the United States. But I'm talking about nominally, not in real terms, not priced in gold or even some of the other currencies around the world. Because stocks are not going up because the economy is improving. They're not going. That has nothing to do with the economy. Stocks are going up despite the fact that the economy is worsening. That's reality. But I think one thing is true on the economy. I think that the global economy is not nearly as bad off as everybody thought. And I've always maintained that we are not headed for a global depression, that this is an American depression, that if anything, most of the world is actually going to benefit from the fact that they no longer have to support the American economy. Now, based on what happened in 2008, a lot of people are jumping to the erroneous conclusion, in my mind, that that's not the case, that we're going to sink the rest of the world down with us. And I still disagree with that. I think long-term, and I don't think – I'm not talking way in the distant future. I'm talking, you know, in the relative shorter term, we're going to see that decoupling. We're going to see that happening. And, in fact, even look at what's going on right now. The Dow Jones in the last month is up about 10%. Not quite, but about 10%, the Dow Jones. During that same month, the Hang Seng Index in Hong Kong is up almost 50%. You've got five times the gain in Chinese shares as you have in U.S. shares. Now, sure, the Chinese shares fell more in 2008, but of course they rose a lot more in the 7 years leading up to 2008. But be that as it may, in the last month, you're talking about five times again, 50% increase in the Hang Seng, 50%. And, you know, I mean, we're buying foreign stocks every day at Euro Pacific Capital. You know that. And it's getting difficult to price these things because for the last week or two, a lot of these stocks are moving up 5 to 10% a day, every day, day after day after day. Now, granted, again, you know, these stocks were down a lot. And we talked about that a lot on this show. You know, 2008, you know, foreign stocks got hammered. But, you know, what a difference a year makes. I mean, 2009 is starting off to be the biggest year I've ever seen for foreign stocks. So I don't know if this performance is going to continue at this pace from now until the end of the year. Obviously, if it does, all the losses on paper from 2008 will be wiped out for everybody. Now, I don't expect that to happen. I do expect there to be some declines. It would be ridiculous to think stocks, at least this year, will continue at this pace. But it shows you what's going on. And if you look at the economic data coming out of China, it's much, much better than the economic data coming out of the United States. And also, if you look at what's happened to the dollar, you know, the dollar hasn't collapsed. I've been talking about the weak dollar ever since that reversal week 2 weeks ago. But if you look at what's happened since then, since its highs from 2 weeks ago, the dollar index has now dropped by 4%. Now, that might not sound like a lot to you, but it is a lot. That's about a 2% drop per week. You know, in the realm of foreign exchange, that's pretty big. It's not a catastrophe, but it is something that you want to look at. Look at what's happened to the commodity currencies. In those same 2 weeks off their lows, the Canadian and Australian dollars have risen by 8%. So those are some pretty big moves. Look at what's happening to commodities. Look at oil. Oil, crude oil closed above $56 a barrel. That's the highest close in crude oil, I think, since sometime November of last year. We're a bit above some resistance. And I still think that we could hit $100 a barrel by the end of the year. I think the next major target is probably around $70. And, you know, we could be there, I would guess, you know, within a few months, maybe sooner. You know, look at gold stocks. Gold stocks, the QE index, you know, broke to a new multi-month high today. In the last 2 weeks, I think, or maybe a month, but gold stocks are up 20% as measured by that index. And, you know, industrial stocks are up more. Look at some of the oil stocks. Look at some of these Canadian energy trusts. Many of these trusts, and we've been buying these trusts for a long time, and they did get beaten up, you know, last year, some more than others. But most of these trusts have now doubled off their lows, and a lot of that gain has happened in the last several weeks. Some of these stocks have tripled. And we know we've seen that in gold stocks, where most gold stocks seem to have doubled or tripled off their lows. But there are a lot of stocks out there, and more than a handful, that are up four and five times from their lows of October, November of last year. Now, what I ultimately think is going to happen, of course, is that, you know, we're going to see a flight from currencies, from cash into assets. You know, it's interesting when I watch all these other pundits on television who are reveling in this rally, it's like they got the cat that ate the canary. They're so happy, and they're jumping all over the bears. Oh, the bears are wrong. And of course, these are the same guys. These are the same bulls that were denying all these problems, that were buying with both hands when the Dow was at 14,000, that were making fun of people like me or people like Amir Urbini, who were pointing out the problems in the housing market, the problems in the credit market. So they had it so wrong, and now they're criticizing the bears because they're still bearish, and they're proclaiming a bull market. You know, the bear market is over. It's a new bull market. But, you know, as far as they're concerned, they didn't even acknowledge the bear market until it was theoretically over in their mind. But the reality is the bears are not wrong. But to the extent that there are bears out there who are recommending staying in cash, staying in treasuries, then they're going to end up being wrong because they had the wrong a diagnosis for the ultimate disease, because it is inflation that is the problem. And in the short run, the bulls are going to think they're right because the bears who are telling people to stay in cash look wrong. But I'm a bear too, and I was bearish before a lot of these other bears, and I'm not telling anybody to stay in cash. I've never been telling people to stay in cash. I've told people to have some cash, but I've told people to stay away from cash. That cash is the real danger, especially U.S. dollars. And what's going to happen is the bulls who are invested and who think they're right are going to be wrong. And they're being boiled slowly like that proverbial frog in a frying pan. Because what's going to happen is U.S. stocks might continue to go up, but they won't go up as fast as the dollar's going down. They won't go up as fast as inflation. They won't go up as fast as gold. They won't go up as fast as stocks anywhere else in the world. And so the bulls will be getting poorer and poorer, even though they think they're getting richer. Now, of course, the bears, who are right on their outlook for the U.S. economy and how bad the situation is, ironically, they could get even poorer than the bulls if they express their bearishness by seeking out safety in U.S. dollars and U.S. treasuries. And what I can never really square this, how people can be so bearish on our economy and so bearish on our markets, yet simultaneously bullish on our currency. Because if the U.S. economy is a wreck and our markets are going to go down, then why should our currency go up? I mean, it has no intrinsic value. The only thing that gives the dollar value is the strength of our economy. And if the economy is weak, why should we expect the currency to be strong? And if they're printing money like there's no tomorrow, if we're running enormous deficits and we're socializing our economy, if we're abandoning free markets and embracing centralized government planning, how is that possibly a recipe for a stronger currency? It's not. And, you know, it would be very fitting that just before they destroyed cash, right, they got everybody convinced that cash was the place to be. Because as I've said all along, the biggest losses are going to be felt by the people who stayed in cash. And the people who stayed in cash in 2008 or went to cash thought they did the right thing, patted themselves on the back, criticized anybody who was invested in assets because they said, you see, it's the big deflation. Well, it would be very fitting if this is what happened. Just before they kill cash and destroy the cash, they get everybody to pile into it. And then the asset prices start to rise and rise fast. And that's, again, really what I think is going on. Stocks are not rising because people are gaining confidence in the economy. Stocks are rising because people are losing confidence in cash. And it's not just a dollar. I'm talking about all forms of currency. I think all currencies are losing value. Ultimately, the dollar is losing value faster. And if I'm right on this movement back into stocks, and if this rally in stocks continues, you know, if the Dow continues to rise, you know, right now it's 8,500. Let's say it rises to 9,500 or 10,000. Maybe it will do that before another pullback. I don't know. I mean, it might pull back tomorrow. But if it keeps rising, the dollar should keep falling. And ultimately, it can fall hard. Because the dollar benefited as everybody was trying to get out of assets and into cash. Well, the dollar is going to suffer when everybody is trying to get out of cash and into stuff. And any way you slice it, I think that if the foreign markets are going to way outperform the domestic markets. I don't see how the U.S. market can outperform. And so even if you're bullish on the U.S. economy and you're bullish on U.S. stocks, just buy foreign stocks because I think they're going to do better. I think no matter what, if the U.S. market goes up, I think foreign stocks are going to go up more. And if you're bearish on the U.S. economy, you're bearish on the dollar, but I think you still buy foreign stocks. I think no matter how you slice it, whether you're bullish or bearish, the answer is you invest abroad. You invest in foreign stocks. I think you're going to ultimately win either way, especially if you buy value, especially if you get good dividend yield. You know, I'm convinced of that. But we'll see what happens in the near term. One thing that makes me think that maybe the market will sell off is because so many people are bullish. But the one thing that gives me comfort in the fact that maybe they'll keep rising is because people are bullish for the wrong reasons, and they're still focusing on nominal gains. They're focusing on the puny nominal gains in the U.S. and ignoring the enormous nominal gains overseas, and they're ignoring what's going on in commodities. And ultimately, if we do see this big spike in commodity prices, which could be coming, oil goes to 7 at 100 and other commodities keep rising, that's going to push up the inflation numbers. That's going to make it worse for Americans who are unemployed or who are having their pay reduced, now having to deal with a higher cost of living. And ultimately, it's going to mean higher interest rates. And in fact, interest rates have already been rising. The last couple of days, though, interest rates have kind of held steady. You know, the yield on the 10-year right now is around 3.15. The yield on the 30-year is just under 4.1. Bonds have gone sideways for the last couple of days. My guess is that the Fed is really in there buying treasuries right now. In fact, they had an auction today. I think it went all right. My bet is that the Fed was in there buying them with both hands. I think the Fed is sensing problems in the bond market, and they're doing everything they can to try to artificially prop up bond prices and keep a lid on interest rates. And that could be another reason that we're seeing this burst in commodity prices, a little bit weakness in the dollar, strength in stocks, because of that new money entering the system, all that inflation coming in, and people are starting to understand what this game is, understand how it all ends up. And it's not stocks that crash, it's currencies. The risk is not being in stocks, the risk is being in cash. I've always thought that way, even though last year was a good year for cash and a bad year for stocks, it's just one year. And I think in the scheme of things, it's going to be a little blip on the radar screen, and what we need to be in is in cash. I think there's far more risk being out in the market, and you have to understand, it could be a bumpy ride, especially, look, people who have, you know, opened up accounts with us, you know, since last October, you know, obviously, you know, that's when they started, you know, they're doing really, really well. But if you start now, if somebody opens up an account now, you know, is it possible that after some of these stocks are up 50 to 100% in just a few months, could they pull back 20 or 30%? Absolutely. You've got to be willing to accept the fact. Does that mean you should say, you know what, Peter? I didn't get in at the lows in October or November. I didn't buy that dip in March, but I'm going to wait. I'm going to sit on cash, and I'm going to wait for a pullback. That's a bigger mistake, because what if that pullback never comes, and you're just sitting there in cash? You know, we had a client, I think, just recently that liquidated, against our advice, about $8 million worth of gold bullion. And I think he sold it about $50, $60 lower than it is now, because he was convinced that gold was going to go back down to $650 and he was going to buy it back. And my point was like, well, who cares if it goes to $650? You know, big deal. What if it doesn't go to $650? What if it goes to $1,250 and you haven't bought it back? What are you going to do? And I don't think those are decisions that you want to make. I think this is too big a deal. There's so much risk, I think, in holding the U.S. currency that you don't want to do it. That you've got to be willing to accept that this could be a bumpy ride, but the final destination, I think if you're investing the right way, you know, it's going to make up for it, believe me. And I think the costs of being in cash are far too great. So, yeah, I would buy. Even though stocks have moved up a lot, I would buy. And, you know, think about this. Stocks, even, let's assume a hypothetical Euro Pacific Capital, they really got clobbered. Let's say they got clobbered in 2008. They came in at the absolute highs, and they bought some speculative stocks, and they were down 60% in 2008. That person could, you know, let's say now they've had a 50% gain in 2009. Well, just because they've had a 50% gain, you think, well, that's a lot. I can't buy stocks after a 50% run-up. But that guy is still now down 40%. Because if you're down 60% and then you rise 50%, you're still down 40%. So don't think about the fact that the stocks are 50% more expensive than they were a couple of months ago. Think about them as 40% cheaper than they were a year ago. But here's what you don't want to miss. If we get another 50% move, just like we had a 50% move in the last few months, if we get another one, then that guy who was down 60% is only down 10%. Now it's almost all the way back. So you don't want to miss another 50% move. I think people need to get invested. If they had money on the sidelines, they need to move it in. Maybe you don't have to move it all in. Maybe there'll be a little bit of a pullback. I wouldn't be surprised if there was, but I don't want to bet on it. Because what if the market goes up? What if the Dow goes up another 1,000 points to 9,500, and meanwhile, the foreign markets go up another 20%, or the dollar goes down 10%, and then we finally get a big pullback, but we're not even pulling back to where we are now. I think you can't make that mistake or be too greedy or too fearful. You have to understand the big picture, and you have to invest accordingly. You've got to understand that it's money that's being debased, that the risk to your future is not that you own stocks and the stocks go down, but that you own cash and the cash goes down. Don't think about losing money. Think about your money losing purchasing power. And when you put it in the proper perspective, you will understand exactly what you need to do. Anyway, let me quickly go to the phones. First, let me take Eric in New Jersey.
Yes, hi, how are you? I just want to mention your great, great patriot, and I listen every week. And I've read both of your books.
Thank you.
Very quickly, you had mentioned earlier that that you're a huge proponent of the gold standard, and I definitely agree with that. However, I know that there are some people, especially, I guess, some sort of libertarians, that they're against the gold standards. Like, I guess, the Milton Friedman types, they blame the Depression on the gold standard. I was wondering what your thoughts are on that. I know it's off topic, but I'm not...
It's not off topic. I mean, first of all, gold is not the reason we had a Depression. Anything but, look, politicians always want to blame our problems on gold, because they don't like the gold standard, because gold is what imposes discipline on politicians. They're trying to find ways to get out from under that discipline. Just like, you know, kids at the prom, you know, want to ditch the chaperone, right? You know, they don't want somebody, you know, monitoring their action, right? They you know, so it's the same thing. And, you know, what happens is, under a gold standard, if politicians want to spend money, they need gold. And if they don't have it, they have to take it from their citizens in the form of taxation. But if they can get out from under the gold standard and convince us to accept printing press money, then whenever they want to spend money, they just print it up. And they can pretend that it doesn't cost us anything. And then when prices go up, they'll blame it on, you know, greedy foreigners or labor unions or anybody else but their own printing press. So it's all nonsense. They all have their own objective. They want to blame gold. You want to know why there was a Great Depression? You know, read Murray Rothbard's book on the Great Depression. I recommend it on my website. You know, read my books, or you said you've read them. The Depression was caused by government. Hoover created the Depression.
Roosevelt. Prosperity. Right.
Well, first you have the boom is the problem with malinvestments. Then you have a bust. But what turns a bust into a depression, what makes a recession a depression, is when governments interfere with the market's attempt to rebalance the economy. Mm-hmm. So that's the problem. Even though the Fed blew up a stock market bubble in 1929, we didn't have to have a depression when it busted. We could have just had a severe recession, or we could have had a depression that lasted a year or two. It wouldn't have lasted a decade. What made it last so long was all the things Hoover and Roosevelt did. And we're repeating all the same mistakes, only we're making them bigger, and we're doing it at a time when our economy is in even worse shape.
Right. Very, very quickly, I was wondering if you'd be available to speak at a law school, where obviously you would get paid. I'm not sure what your schedule is.
You got to call my office and speak to Mike Finger. Call my office, you know, and not on the show, and speak to Mike Finger. You know, my schedule is very busy. Just so we know, I'm speaking at the New York Hard Asset Conference in New York City. I think we got about 600-700 people signed up to attend. Make sure you get there early so you get a seat, because I don't think there's that many seats there. That's on. I'm speaking to everybody, not just you, Eric.
Right.
That's on a Monday in New York at the Hard Asset Conference. But I'm traveling over the following day, Tuesday. I'm flying up actually in a private plane up to, I think, Calgary or I forget, someplace in Canada. I'm speaking somewhere in Canada at a conference. Then I go back up to Canada again a couple of weeks for a different conference. I forget, they're on my schedule. And in the meantime, I go out to Abu Dhabi. I'm speaking all over the world now and flying around, and so I don't know, but you can call up and inquire about my schedule.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Eric. Next call is Sean up in Toronto.
Hey, Peter.
New Brunswick. That's where I'm going on Tuesday, New Brunswick. Anyway, go ahead.
Just a comment. We had a guy up on one of the business shows here, and he was talking about, I guess, the derivatives market. And that kind of tied into what you were talking about this stress test. Now, he's saying it's like back in the Middle Ages or something, where they were selling like 20 people on one plot of land. And he's saying that when Hank Paulson first asked for that $780 billion and then came back 10 days later and said that he changed his mind and they were just going to give the banks the money to loan, he was saying that this derivatives market could be like $600 trillion leveraged throughout the world. I'm not sure if you've had any numbers.
Look, I know
like
there's a lot of leverage out there, and the numbers are so big that it just seems like an exercise in futility to try to, you know, play around with them. It's just enormous.
Yeah, so I was wondering, I got silver here. I bought it at 970 an ounce. I had to pay a 20% premium because our dollar was so low then. So I guess it turned out to like $10.40 an ounce. How is that going to be affected if our dollar really rises up here?
Well, if the Canadian dollar rises?
Yeah.
Well, I expect the Canadian dollar to rise, but I expect gold to rise faster, so you should be okay, and silver to rise even faster.
Okay.
Yeah,
it just seems like the banks up here are really putting a high premium on buying the bullion, like per ounce. So I'm just wondering, have you heard anything about like a shortage of supply or anything like that?
I don't know. There's always people talking about a shortage of physical silver or gold, and ultimately that's going to happen. And I think there's going to be a squeeze. I think you've got going to have problems for people who are, you know, in the derivatives market, short silver, or you know, like they can't deliver their contracts or can't get the physical to deliver into a contract. Look, eventually there's going to be a lot of problems. There's going to be a rush to get into gold and silver because I think they're going to be remonetized. People are going to realize that, you know, if they want to have any savings, if they want, you know, they want to be able to buy stuff in the future, they better buy gold and silver right now because who knows what, if anything, their paper is going to buy, certainly if that paper is the U.S. dollar. Anyway, thanks for the call.
Have a good night.
Hey, you know, before I forget, I want to mention that somebody sent me a video on YouTube, which I see is going around because it's got over 5 million views. And it's an interesting clip that I never saw from Fox News. They did a report, and this is about the middle of last year, where they went over all the warnings that had been made about Freddie and Fannie. And I knew I was warning, but apparently George Bush warned Alan Greenspan, several people, Treasury Secretary Snow, very sharp warnings about a potential financial crisis, an economic collapse, really strong words that basically describe what happened if we don't rein in Freddie and Fannie, if we don't regulate Freddie and Fannie. And the Democrats in Congress basically, you know, Barney Frank, if you watch this thing and you look at the stuff that Barney Frank says, it's absolutely amazing. He should be run out of town. I mean, 100% wrong. And then basically they brought something up, and apparently on the Senate Banking Committee, 100% of the Republicans actually voted for this regulation of Fannie and Freddie, and all the Democrats voted against it. And I think Schumer was a big guy against it, as was Dodd in Connecticut, and they scuttled it, and the Republicans didn't bring it to a vote because they didn't have the votes. But it was very partisan. But it's clear that the one time when the Republicans wanted regulation, the Democrats said no. And the interesting thing is they wanted to regulate a government agency, which I'm all for. I mean, the only reason Freddie and Fannie needed regulation was because they were government-sponsored, because they had these, which meant the market wasn't regulating. So either the market has to regulate companies or the government. But here you had a situation where companies were regulated by nobody. They weren't regulated by the free market, and they weren't regulated by the government. You see, most companies don't need government regulation because they're regulated by the free market, because people won't lend them too much money because they're afraid they won't get it back. There's a natural cap. But because Fannie and Freddie were guaranteed by the government, no one cared how much money they borrowed. It didn't matter how many trillions, because everybody knew, well, the government's good for it. The government's got a printing press. So that was the problem. But it's interesting, if you watch this video and see how strong some of the language was, that there's a potential problem here that can be a catastrophe, and how strong the language was by people like Barney Frank saying, this is crazy, this is fear-mongering, Freddie and Fannie are fantastic, they're great, everything is perfect, there's nothing to worry about. I mean, it's just unreal to listen to that stuff. Anyway, let me pick up with, am I done with Andy in Kansas? Yeah, let me go to Mark in Illinois.
Hello?
Mark, are you there?
Yeah, I'm there. Can you hear me, Peter?
I got you.
All right, cool. Thanks for everything that you do. You know, you're a real patriot. Through you, I was turned on to Mises.org and Lou Rockwell, and I want to give a shout-out for the Ron Paul Investment Club of Southeast Michigan. But anyway, here's my situation. I'm 29 years old. I'm a design engineer, and I was transferred from Michigan out to Illinois because my branch closed. I'm in the hole about $10,000 in credit card debt. I'm losing $500 a month on my property back in Michigan, and I have about $8,000 in personal savings and stocks. Should I pay down this credit card debt, or do I?
Well, under normal circumstances, I would say yes. But even under your circumstances, I might say yes. I mean, what's the interest rate on that credit card debt?
7.9%.
I mean, that's not that terrible. You know, I don't know. I mean, what do you own? What do you own with the money?
Oh, with the money, I own a couple of penny stocks, and the rest is in savings.
Well, A, it makes no sense to have money in savings earning 1 or 2% and you're paying credit card debt. So obviously it's better to pay off your credit card debt than to leave the money in a savings account.
As far as penny stocks,
you know, if they're real legitimate penny stocks, I wouldn't encourage people to buy penny stocks while they still have credit card debt. Because in effect, what you're doing is you're buying penny stocks with credit cards. So I mean, that's a lot of gambling. If you had more conservative stocks and had bigger dividends, and you know, or at least gold bullion or silver or something that wasn't as risky, you know, I might be inclined to do that given how much inflation I think there's going to be. But I'm not a big fan of credit card debt, and especially at some point, you know, they can probably raise your rates. And what if they raise your rates to 8%, 15% or 20%, and you know, your stocks have gone down, and now you're in a bind. So it's, you know, I don't like adjustable rate debt. I mean, the only time I think it makes sense to have debt when you're buying really is if it's a fixed rate debt that you've locked in, or, you know, if it's a reasonable amount of debt, like you're in a margin account and you don't have too much margin and you're paying, you know, margin interest, which is a lot lower than credit card interest.
Okay, well, I was asking the question because, you know, being in the automotive field, you know, the hammer can drop at any time. And I was wondering if it makes more sense just to have some just-in-case money, because if I lose my job,
well,
but you know,
just-in-case money is not having cash but still having credit card debt. Just-in-case money is having actual savings. So what you should do is get rid of your credit card debt and start saving. And that's having real just-in-case money. And keep your savings in gold or silver. That's even better.
Okay.
All right. Well, thanks for the call.
All right.
Okay, and next up, Mike in New York. Mike, you there? Hello? Oh, I lost. Okay, what about Kim in Illinois?
Hi.
Hi, Kim.
Can you hear? Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Oh, good, good. I have several quick questions, but first I want to say I admire your father tremendously. What a hero.
So much.
And also props to the guy who put your YouTube channel together. Boy, I don't know what I'd do without that.
Which one? There's so many. I just started mine, but there's so many other YouTube channels that feature my stuff. So.
I think it's called the Peter Schiff channel.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, there's a number of people, you know, that have it. In fact, I was surprised when I finally, on my video blog, I decided to just put the stuff directly on YouTube because everybody was putting up there anyway. And I thought it would be easy if we had my blog and I just put it up there so other people wouldn't have to copy it and put it up on YouTube. And so I thought the other YouTubers would be happy at me. Instead, a bunch of them were mad at me. Like, hey, why are you doing this? My whole idea was I thought if we didn't have my video blog on 10 different blogs, if everybody was watching it, let's say, on one, that we'd have a lot more views and that would bring more attention to the whole thing, you know. That was my thought.
Well, I didn't know that you had a channel. I thought this was
The channel I just launched is called, I think it's Schiff Report. Although there's a couple that sounds similar to that. But I just set one up on my own. But it really doesn't matter where you watch it. It's the same videos. I was hoping that if more people watched it on one, then you know it would show up in YouTube higher when people are looking for, hey, what's popular? And then they saw my blog, you know.
Yeah, well, that's a good idea. Maybe everybody should just kind of get together and find one place. Because that's what's important is to get that front page, you know, on YouTube.
Yeah, I'm just trying to get the message out. But anyway, go ahead. What's your question or comment?
Okay, I have a couple, and I don't expect you to answer them all, but I'm just hoping that maybe you'll think about a couple of these, maybe answer them later. I'll just run through the topics quick. One, I'm concerned about investing in China just because it's a communist nation, and they have a terrible human rights situation. I'm also interested in how you feel about this home destruction that the banks are doing. They're actually knocking down homes that are almost finished because of the cost.
I saw a YouTube video of that, and I really think it is disgraceful. And I think part of it happened because of fees. But it seemed like some of these homes were, if they weren't, you know, complete, they certainly looked 90-95% complete to me.
Me too.
With people who are homeless, with people who are poor, anybody, I mean, why would we take a house that's already been built, that we've already spent the money constructing it, we spent the resources, we used the material, we spent the labor, and it's actually going to cost money to demolish them? Why not just give them away? or at least find somebody who can demonstrate an ability to afford the maintenance and the property taxes, and just let them have it. This is ridiculous. And it also shows you how crazy it is that the government is still trying to encourage home builders to build new homes. They're trying to give tax incentives to home builders. They're trying to give people tax breaks for buying homes when they're destroying homes. It makes no sense.
I know,
this is
it's
the
crazy.
Insane world that we live in.
And that's what it feels like. It's totally insane.
What was the first part of your question? I forgot.
Well, I want to just give you the list and then, you know, take and pick and choose what you want to answer or maybe think about them for later. Well, I wanted to throw out there H.R. 1207. I wanted to ask you about, are you running for Congress? And most of all, I think I wanted to find out, you know, this whole sense of trust or lack of trust that we have in banks and Wall Street and government. I mean,
the lack of trust is well deserved. I mean, there's nothing to trust. I mean, these guys are in it for themselves. They're either incompetent or liars or a combination of both. A government policy, bad fiscal policy, bad monetary policy got us into this mess, and bad monetary and fiscal policy is making the mess worse. So there's no reason to trust anybody in government. They're not our friends. They're not here to help us. They're our enemies. That's the terrorists are not, you know, in the desert somewhere in the Middle East. They're in Congress. They're in the White House. They're at the Fed. They're right here in Washington, D.C. That's who's been terrorizing our country. That's what we have to concentrate on. But they want us worried about the terrorists halfway around the world who really don't have the power to harm us the way our own politicians do. They can harm us more with cheap money and their tax and their regulations than any of these guys can do halfway around the world.
It does feel like economic terrorism right now, and not only the government, but also Wall Street, the Fed.
And it's not just economic. They're terrorizing our liberties. They're taking away our liberties. They're taking away our freedoms. Supposedly, that's why we're afraid of terrorists, because they endanger our liberty. Well, our government is endangering our liberty. So they're terrorists by any way you want to define it.
Then what's taking so long to say this plainly? What? For the American people to rise up and actually revolt.
Maybe they will. I don't know. We had those tea parties. That was very passive. It wasn't, you know, I mean, you know, somebody called up earlier mentioning my father. I mean, maybe more people will just stop paying taxes. You know, I mean, I wish foreigners would stop lending money to our government. If people, I mean, certainly stop buying government bonds. I mean, don't lend Washington any money, because all they're going to do is use it to undermine our economy. They're driving us into debt, and they're encouraging more consumption. They're making the problem worse. The more money the government gets, the worse the problems are going to get. I mean, I don't know.
Well, we're trying to get out of it.
Hopefully, something happens.
It is making it worse. It's making it worse. But that brings me back to the first one, which is, you know, investing in foreign stocks, and I mean in the sense.
Oh, now I remember. You're worried about China. Look, don't be. China's a communist country in name only. Their economic system is not communism, it's capitalism. It's not pure capitalism, you know, it's not perfect, but it's a lot better than what's going on in most other places in the world. It's certainly a lot better than the capitalism we have in America.
I have a problem with 14-hour work days and 49 cents an hour for labor and no...
You know what? I have a problem with those low wages, too. And when the Chinese stop pushing their currency down and stop propping up the dollar, Chinese wages are going to go a lot higher, and Chinese citizens are going to get to enjoy the fruits of their own labor. That's going to happen, and that's one of the reasons that I'm heavily investing in stocks that are exposed to the Chinese market, because as the American consumer dies, the Chinese consumer is going to be born, and there's a billion of them.
All right.
Anyway,
that's
thanks
true.
For the call.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next up is Mike in New York.
Hi, Peter. I had a quick question for you. I was wondering if you think the impending currency crisis will result in buying opportunities, and should I be saving a percentage of the wad for such an occasion?
Well, if there's a currency crisis, you have to have already bought. You can't hold on to your currency hoping to buy things in a currency crisis, because the currency collapses. So if you're looking for opportunity to profit from a currency crisis, you have to get out of the currency before the crisis. And that's exactly what my whole philosophy is.
Well, I'm in other currencies as well.
Yeah, well, but, you know, it's a global currency crisis, then all currencies lose value relative to gold and other assets, which I think is going to be the case based on all the money printing that's going around. But, you know, I think that the dollar will lose more value than most other currencies. And I think certainly, you know, if you have a lot of gold bullion, you know, you can use your gold to try to buy assets. But, you know, I'm buying assets now. I mean, I think there are assets that are going to do very well with a high inflation environment. You know, you get a lot of these stocks that have a lot of natural resources or commodities that have real assets and they've got good earnings. I mean, some of these stocks could move up dramatically in an environment where you have rapid debasement of money.
Okay.
All right, thanks for the call.
All right.
Next up, and I think I've got, this is my last call, so I've got some open lines if anyone wants to call, 888-678-9597, 888-678-9597. Let me go to Fred in New Jersey.
Hey, Peter, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I became convinced of your inflation scenario over the past couple months. Not that I was completely doubting it, but I thought the credit market, tightening would be a countervailing force for a long time. But I heard two of Obama's economic advisors, Summers as well as Robert Reich, talk about the debt to GDP ratio as being what they're focusing on. So they're not worried about the debt as much, as long as they can get GDP to grow.
Well, this is all nonsense. This is government propaganda trying to justify it. First of all, these are two guys that didn't see this crisis coming, that assured us everything was great a couple of years ago. Now they're telling us that the problem could be solved with big government spending. The problem with this nonsense about debt to GDP is that our GDP number is all a bunch of fluff. It's 70% consumer spending. It's not real. And a lot of it is also just made up by statisticians. If you look at our debt compared to the manufacturing part of our GDP, it's enormous. You know, the real wealth-producing part, if you take manufacturing, mining, agriculture, maybe construction, the real meat of it, the debt is enormous. But then you have to look at the debt relative to domestic savings. You know, other countries where you have a high debt to GDP, they also have a lot of personal savings so that the government is able to borrow from their own citizens. But in the United States, not only is the government in debt, but all the citizens are in debt. So in order for the U.S. government to borrow money, it has to borrow it from the Chinese. It has to borrow it from the Japanese. So our deficits are inherently much less sustainable when we don't have the money ourselves. And then the third thing that they don't factor into is our debt is financed short-term. Most other countries in the world are not that stupid. They finance their long-term government expenditures with long-term bonds. We've got an adjustable-rate mortgage. I think a third of the debt comes due next year. So if there's a spike in short-term interest rates, look what happens to the cost of servicing this massive national debt. The government is making the same mistake that we made with adjustable-rate mortgages, assuming that everything is okay and ignoring what happens when the teaser rate expires. So this is all nonsense. Tune all this stuff out. Whenever you listen to these guys talking from the administration, it is all propaganda, nothing but. Whatever they're saying, you can rest assured the opposite is true.
I definitely appreciate those comments, and I believe that more and more when I listen to the way you describe how it's happening behind the scenes. Just one other question. Do you have an asset class that you think the Fed is going to blow up with all their money printing, like the housing market or the NASDAQ in the early 90s?
No, there isn't another bubble. I think they're finished blowing bubbles. I think all the inflation that they create is going to show up in commodity prices and consumer prices and things like that. It's not going to be stocks or bonds. I mean, stocks or real estate. Ultimately, stocks and real estate prices will rise. No question about that. They will rise in nominal terms, but they will fall even further in real terms. I think on a real basis, our assets are going to get crushed in this country. Unfortunately, prices measured in gold are going to get crushed. I still expect the Dow to trade down near 1 ounce of gold. You know, right now it's more like, I don't know, 9 ounces of gold. It got down below 8 ounces of gold, a month or so ago. But, you know, it started at 43 ounces in 2000. This bear market ain't over.
Well, thanks for taking my call.
Anyway, thanks for the call. Hey, before I grab the next call, I wanted to, you know, just remember, too, you know, it's amazing how, you know, so many people just, you know, have brushed aside my investment advice. You know, I was reading, someone sent me, and I read this article that somebody wrote on the Seeking Alpha, and the guy is writing a story critical of some, you know, scamsters on CNBC that are basically bait and switching, you know, gold bullion. And there's a lot of you know, that type of business going out among the gold bullion world. I mean, there's some very reputable dealers, but there are also some shady dealers. And if you're going to buy gold, and I'm, you know, in the process of probably, everybody knows I sell Perth Mint. I've been doing a lot of business in the Perth Mint. I'm also going to be moving into selling physical gold for delivery. I'm not sure, exactly when it's going to start, but it will start. But in the meantime, if you want to buy physical gold coins, Krugerrands, Maple Leafs, you know, junk silver, I'm not selling those. I will be doing it at some point soon. But in the meantime, you know, you can buy them at other reputable dealers. But if you are calling up to buy this stuff, do not let people talk you into collectibles or some type of numismatics or some kind of – because there's a lot of – you know, huge markups. And of course, this guy, you know, there could be, you know, hundreds of percent markups or, you know, so it is, there are a lot of, you know, disreputable people in that industry, in addition to the many reputable people that are there. But my point is, in this article, in the middle of the article, he's basically, you know, jumping on CNBC, and he mentions that, you know, CNBC have people on like Peter Schiff touting gold, despite the fact that he has a horrible track record or horrific track record. And it's interesting how somehow there's now a reputation out there that I've got this horrible track record. I mean, A, I don't even have an official track record because I'm not managing money. I own a brokerage firm. But where's all this coming from? I mean, you got that one blogger who wrote the article about my accounts being down in 2008. You know, nothing secret about that. We talk about it all the time. And the Wall Street Journal article that highlighted three of my clients whose accounts were also down in 2008. And, of course, we just looked at the stock portions of their accounts, not, you know, the precious metals that they might have had. But how is all of a sudden I have a lousy track record because my clients were down in 2008? I mean, that's like saying Warren Buffett has a lousy track record because his clients were down in 2008. What about the 20 years before 2008? You know, I mean, a track record is not a year. So people are just saying that, oh, I have this lousy track record. They have no idea, you know, what I was advising people for the 10 years before 2008, and they have no idea what's happened in 2009. It just strikes me as amazing how that feeling is out there. But, you know, again, it's very apropos. You know, I think just before my investment strategies just completely take off and are 100% validated, just before that is when people are able to discredit it. And as I said, you know, when some of this criticism first began leveling at me, I was saying that I think the people who are criticizing my investment forecast at the end of 2008 are going to look just as foolish as the people look now who were forecasting my economic forecasts at the end of 2007. Anyway, the last call of the night up in Canada, in Ottawa, is that Elton? Hello? Ottawa, Canada, are you there?
Yeah, my name is Elton, and I'm calling from Ottawa, Canada.
Yes, you're on the air.
Yeah, I love watching your show. It's really, really the real one. But most of them on CNBC and other sites are just propaganda. And I'm still a new investor. I haven't started putting money in. But how come the stock market and the real economic data are not relating? Just to get some idea from you.
How come what?
How come the stock market, which is reeling 35% up, and economic data, the first quarter is 35% down in profit, and it's not relating anywhere?
Look, you know, the markets sometimes have no basis. Look at the big rise in the home builders. Look at the big buys in the financials. You know, maybe a lot of this is short covering. Sometimes the stocks with the weakest fundamentals have the biggest rallies because you have the most short covering going on. You know, I just tune this out. I mean, it's all a bunch of nonsense. The people who are bullish on the U.S. stock market do not understand what's going on. And they may think they're right because they may see U.S. stock prices going up. But it's not validating what they're saying because they're not paying attention to the big picture. They're not paying attention to inflation or the value of the dollar or what's happening beyond American borders. We are in a serious, serious crisis. And ultimately, the stock market going up isn't going to change that. And, you know, look at the stock performance in Zimbabwe. I mean, stocks are up, you know, 1,000,000,000% or whatever. But, you know, no one's making any money, and the economy is a mess. So you can't judge an economy based on nominal stock prices, especially when there's massive inflation and the central banks are doing what they're, you know, like what they're doing in America. You just can't. But these people are clueless, and they never understood the problems with the U.S. economy before the collapse. They thought we had a great economy when we were living in a bubble. So they were clueless now.
So are they creating another bubble?
Well, I mean, I think the bubble has burst. I don't think we're creating another one. We're trying to reflate the old one, and it's my my theory that it can't be done, that there's so many holes in that bubble that it can't be blown back up.
Okay.
Anyway, that's it. Well, look, thanks for the call. I'm glad I got, you know, I had three calls today from Canada. So
thank you so much, Peter. Keep up the good work.
Enjoy that strengthening currency. Look at that Canadian dollar go. Is it up 8% the last couple of weeks?
I know. It's going to be a par very soon.
Yeah. All right. Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Anyway, you know, in all seriousness, I don't know, you know, is this rally going to continue uninterrupted? I mean, obviously, it's not going to always be uninterrupted. I don't know when the next correction is, how big it's going to be. But I am 100% convinced that the risk, again, is being in cash, not in stocks, not in foreign stocks, rather. You want to lock up good dividends while you can. You want to buy stocks while they're still cheap. And even those stocks, and there's a lot of stocks that I own, my clients own, I own, that have doubled and tripled off their lows, that can still double and triple again to get back up to their highs from last year. So there is a lot of upward momentum left in this market. You know, even though we've had a big move in the last month or two, stocks around the world are not expensive. They're just less cheap than they were a month ago. That's all. And it doesn't mean they can't go down. It doesn't mean you can't buy a stock and it can't go down. When stocks are going up 5 and 10% a day, they can certainly drop 5 or 10% a day. But you can't be worried about that. I think the bigger risk is being too afraid to be in stocks and having too much in cash and then waking up one day and finding out that you're broke. You just have to understand the big picture, buy the right assets, and tune out the volatility. And if you get dips and you don't need your dividends, reinvest them. Or if it makes you feel better, maybe, you know, take a partial position. But do not sit back and sit in cash and think you're going to ride this out in cash. Don't take the mistake that this other client made by selling $8 million worth of gold because you think it might go down to 650. You know what? Maybe it will go down to 650. I don't know. But I would rather own the gold. And you know what? If it goes up another $100, he's probably going to be sweating it out. He's probably going to be very nervous. You know, is he going to be able to sit back? Is he going to be able to stay in the market waiting for it to go to 650? What if it spikes up to 1,200? And then he says, oh, I got to buy, and he buys, and then it goes down to 900. Then what is he going to do? Is he going to sell it back? And then, you know, for peace of mind, if you understand what you're doing, if you're bullish on gold, don't try to be cute. Don't try to sell it. And, you know, I've been buying gold for people in the Perth Mint now, since 2002, never solicited a single sale. All we've done is buy. Believe me, we make a commission when you sell and when you buy. I don't need the money. Keep the money, keep the gold, don't sell it. And if you don't own your gold, call up and buy it. You know, Perth Mint. You can call directly to Euro Pacific Capital. We have the number in Newport Beach. There's a direct number for Perth Mint. And the number there is on my website, 800-993-8350, 800-993-8350. And also, as far as common stocks, opening up a brokerage account, call. If you have a broker, call them up, 800-727-7922. If you haven't opened up your account yet, by all means, what are you waiting for? And if you're still in U.S. stocks, why? You've got U.S. stocks up 10%, Hong Kong stocks up 50% in the same month, and Hong Kong is just one market. All the major foreign markets are outperforming the U.S. market. I expect that to continue. I expect the outperformance to get even greater and greater over time. So if you lost a lot of money in U.S. stocks, I think it's a lot better, a lot easier to make it back in foreign stocks so you can still make that switch. You can take a tax loss on your U.S. stocks. You can reposition yourself abroad. If you're sitting on cash, I think you're in the wrong asset. You're listening to too many people who are telling you that everything is going to hell in a handbasket, so you should hold the dollar. Well, if everything is going to hell in a handbasket, that includes the dollar. The dollar is very risky. The dollar is the focal point, the center of all the problems. It is not going to emerge from this crisis unscathed. That is where the real damage is. That is where the real crisis is coming. So you got to prepare for that. Anyway, at Euro Pacific Capital, it's 800-727-7922, 800-727-7922. I will see many of you in New York on Monday and some of you up in Canada on Tuesday. And I should be back live for another episode of Wall Street Unspun next Wednesday. And we'll see if it's been another big week or if we've had a pullback. We'll see then. Anyway, thanks everybody for listening. This is Peter Schiff from Wall Street Unspun. And remember, if you haven't bought my books, Crash Proof, How to Profit from the Coming Economic Collapse, and the little book of bull moves in bear markets. And certainly since that book came out in October of 08, it has been a huge move up. I know everything went down in the 6 months before that book was published, but that book came out right at the lows. And so far, everything that I wrote in that book is finally happening. It just happened after I wrote it, not before it came out. Anyway, thanks a lot, everybody. Be here next week.